Bandwidth and hosting for the British Tech Network is provided by UK2.net. Innovative, affordable, and reliable web hosting.
Good evening and welcome to the web show on the British Tech Network. I'm Paul Wheatley and we are here this evening to discuss the ins and outs, ups, downs, max and minimum widths of responsive design. Now in the past I've struggled to pull together a panel for previous topics, but to be honest I had absolutely no problem for tonight's show. So to begin with, in no particular order, we have Ord Saunders. How are you this evening, Ord?
I'm losing my voice a bit, but I'll struggle through.
It's kind of integral to this kind of thing, but we'll push on nonetheless. And next on the line we have Joe Leach. How are you?
Hey Paul, how you doing? I'm good.
I'm very good, thank you. You all researched and ready to go tonight?
I'm ready to go. Yeah.
Good.
I've had all week responsive design, so there's nothing better than coming home and having to talk about it as well.
Well, I don't know whether that's necessarily a good or a bad thing, but at least you'll be well versed in it.
Yes.
Next one along, Ian. My co-host on the iOS show. How are you tonight, Ian?
I'm good, thanks, Paul. I'm annoyed that you came to me before the end of the introductions, though, because I wanted to say that this could be the first breakpoint in the show, and if you don't want to kind of have the full show experience, you could kind of stop here and skip on a bit.
Well, I'm kind of glad we stopped you doing that, to be honest. It's probably for the best. And next one along, from what I assume is, well, I was going to say it's sunny Australia, but it won't be. It'll be pitch black at the moment. Is Justin Avery. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, Paul. Thanks. How's yourself?
I'm not too bad. Yes, long time no see. It's been quite a few years. I used to work beside Justin many moons ago.
Yeah, it has been a little while. I think I was in London up until, I think, early 2011, and made the move back to Australia and sunny Australia.
Yeah. Very good. It's slightly less than that just now, and probably even worse so in Glasgow for Craig McPhee. How are you tonight?
Yeah, I'm good, Paul. How are you?
Yes, not too bad. Ready to talk responsive design, as if we haven't done that enough at work recently. So, very good. So
flexible.
Indeed. Responsive design. Now, normally I try and find kind of an opening paragraph to explain exactly what responsive design is. And it's a funny one because I actually really struggled to find something that really kind of quickly and effectively described exactly what we want to talk about tonight. So the best one I could find was a quote by Ethan Marcotte, who obviously coined the phrase responsive web design. And basically it's 3 points that really describe what responsive web design is. And number one, a flexible or fluid grid. Number two, responsive images. And number three, media queries. Now, what could we add to that to kind of get a little bit more context around what responsive design is?
Well, technically that is responsive design. A lot of other stuff gets chucked onto it, but that's the definition of what responsive design is.
Grant, so what does it mean to a customer, though? How do you sell this idea in a customer? What's the benefits and what's the downsides?
Well, that's the tricky part, really. I mean, it's one of these... I think selling it into a customer has been the biggest challenge we've had, really, because I suppose number one is it's more expensive than a regular website. But it's kind of the most interesting thing about selling it in is this age old thing that I think everybody's been saying for the last 10 years, which is like almost like a future-proof website, or at least a website that's going to work across all devices that you want to throw at it. But it's never quite that simple.
Yes.
As we all know, having done it.
It is more it's more expensive than a regular website, but obviously in comparison to, say, a desktop website and an iPhone website and a tablet website and another website for some other user group, if you only have to develop it once and it works across a wide variety of platforms, you're saving money. I mean, why wouldn't you?
That's true. It's like three for the price of one, I suppose. Yeah, but I guess the challenge is I think a lot of organizations, certainly the ones I work with, talk a lot about having their mobile. They talk about mobile strategy, which is always my favorite conversations to have. And they say, yeah, we need to have a mobile strategy. And the far as they often get is, we should do an app or should we do a mobile website? And I think it's interesting how it kind of fits into what a lot of organizations see as being the future for them, which is mobile. And a lot of them see it as being still at the moment apps, which is quite interesting.
I think there's a lot of talk at the moment like around that mobile strategy as well. And people are sort of going, well, do I go down the mobile application or a mobile specific website, or do I go down the responsive design website? And it's really up to the client and what they need to achieve. I've been working with some universities lately who are going with a responsive design, but they also want a mobile website as well. So it's something light and easy to download and be quickly accessible for the students around the university. But then, of course, if they do want to fall back, you're not going to push them towards a 960 pixel site designed specifically for the desktop. You can fall back to the responsive design. So while a lot of people are saying, do we do mobile website or responsive design, both is probably the best, but it's whether or not you've got the funds to do that.
Definitely.
Yeah. So in that scenario there, it's actually funny that you mentioned that a university is doing that, because the only other place that I've ever seen the idea whereby they have a responsive website, but then they also have this .mobi site as well, is in universities. And is that because if they've maybe done a bit of user testing or something like that, and it's suggesting that their students are just wanting quick and easy access to their data, so they're going to give them a really, 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 really short and sharp lump of content. And if they want to do a bit more research, the assumption is that they're going to go into the desktop. And I suppose we're then getting into the kind of the mobile versus native argument then a little bit.
You're also getting into the area of context as well. And there's a lot of talk at the moment. It's like, is there actually a mobile context? Like, just because someone's accessing it on the phone, does that mean that they want a second rate website, but do they want a website that has less information than that of a desktop? And we're really taking assumptions when we're sort of delivering content to the user based on what device they're accessing it on.
I think that's the hard part as well. When you're talking to stakeholders and they have mobile phones, everyone has a mobile phone now. So everyone thinks they know mobile, and everyone thinks they know mobile context. And that's part of the tricky part, to re-educate people into away from these cliches that mobile is just geolocation. That's one context. But of course, we know that mobile gets used in the home, and we know that laptops get used out and about. So
mobile is mostly used in a static context. So it's people are actually static when they're using their mobile devices, sat on the sofa, sat at the desk at work. It's even sat on a train is technically a static context. It's very rarely are people wandering around with a 3G connection looking to find what's around the corner. That's actually a very rare but important use case for mobile.
Yeah.
So I've been doing a lot of work on an airport website recently, and they've just about to move to responsive design. And what's been interesting on working with them is they've got a really good mobile site at the moment, which is effectively live departure and arrival times. But in their initial foray into responsive design, the problem was going to be they were going to use their kind of existing website and reflow all the content. And live departures and arrival boards aren't as important for them on their main website as they are on a mobile website. And actually, in reality, responsive design wouldn't work for them, because it was Craig mentioned earlier on that the use cases are different. I think Justin mentioned it, the use cases are different for different devices. So responsive isn't always the answer to what to do about mobile.
I saw an interesting tweet it was a while ago now. When we're talking about what people want on the mobile device and what people want on the desktop, and the airport mobile site is a great example. Our local airport here has an arrival and departure app, which is just basically HTML pages wrapped in an app to be put onto the store. But the tweet sort of went along the lines of if I'm looking at your restaurant on a mobile phone, I want to know your opening hours, your menu, and your phone number. But if I'm looking on the desktop, I want a 2 megabyte picture of someone eating a salad. So it's, if it's not good, if the content isn't good enough for the mobile, we really should be questioning with the clients, is it good enough for the desktop? Whatever content we're actually putting up on the desktop should be suitable for the mobile as well.
Exactly. And by putting up a stripped down mobile website, you're kind of penalizing the desktop users by leaving all that crap up there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I guess that often sounds a bit like a perfect world, I suppose. Certainly if I take this airport example, they were, for example, getting money from various tourist boards to put stuff on the homepage and stuff like that. So it kind of ended up being that, you know, and I'm a UX guy, so I spend my life user testing. But what was happening with this particular site is that they had the business needs of certain content that had to be up there that worked very well on desktop, like, you know, some destination guides, the sort of stuff that would be more suited to a larger screen size. But, you know, when you're going to see, you know, visit, go to the airport to pick somebody up, you need instant live and departure and arrival times there and then. So I don't think it's quite as cut and dried as a lot of people are making it out to be, that responsive is the absolute answer for everything. I think it is an answer, but I don't think it is the answer to mobile.
It depends.
Yeah, exactly.
It depends, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was the same. I worked on a project for Traffic Scotland. We did a lot of user testing and knew the context. So we knew that people were out and about, and we knew that geolocation was one of the number one things that mobile site was used for. So another example, the same as the airport, you know, it just depends. But again, don't make dangerous assumptions.
So in those scenarios, though, so it does depend, but is it dependent on the use case at that particular time, or is it dependent on the organisation? So, for example, should an organisation kind of be taking a strategy and then just firing forward with it, whether that be responsive, whether that be a Tuesday iPad website, or however that happens to be, or should you be looking at each separate thing? So maybe your forms are .mobi, whereas your more marketing pages are responsive design, and then all your service and functions are an app. I mean, what would be the best direction there?
I think it's a really challenge again. I mean, I'm working for, do you guys know the Train Line? UK train company. So they've got a number of things going on at the moment. So they've got a mobile website. They've got a series of apps across all the platforms. And we're just working on a new project with them now. And what's interesting is it's a new site for those guys. And it's like, well, what do we do? Do we, for us to produce a brand new website, we've got to put it inside four different native mobile apps and a mobile version of the website and do a full desktop version of the website. And it's like, well, you know, they've built up this variety of different mobile approaches over the years. And for us to launch a brand new website or a new site, it's going to be really, really tricky to maintain or to produce a whole new set of apps and websites for them for this new project. So it's like, well, again, we do have to look at what's working, but what's kind of happened with their apps is the apps have got onto so many devices now that for us to switch from away from an app back to a responsive design website is going to cause all manner of problems for the users because they're used to using a day-to-day, they're using an app. So it's a real challenge to know what to do when you want to redevelop or start again effectively from what you're producing.
The hardest bit with the app and the mobile, well, the website, the web app versus the native app, I suppose, is the getting it to market. So yeah. It's so easy to put it into an app store and then people find it because people are used to going there. The other day I thought it'd be a good idea to create a location for a bunch of web apps and realize that Apple and Google have already done that. But it's just a matter of educating people. And I think that eventually will come around and people start using more web apps because it's easier to maintain them than the native apps. That's, of course, assuming that you're not going to use native functions for the app anyway.
Yeah, because I mean, I read something recently that said something like 73% of all apps on iPhones are only ever used once.
Yeah, I saw that.
That
yeah.
sounds incredibly high, but it's a high number. It's around that number, but it's certainly a high amount of web apps are only downloaded and used once. So I think it's, like you say, the strategy for people to start using apps as to get onto mobile is a good one, which kind of means that, you know, actually it's cheaper and easier to do a responsive site, whereas, you know, developing a web app is quite a nice, cool thing, and the marketing directors often quite like to have web apps because it's the sort of thing they like to drop into conversations at parties, whereas in reality, responsive design is really sexy for us web designers, but for real people and for most organizations, it's effectively a fairly hidden cost and approach, really.
If you're doing responsive design well, then people might not even notice that you've done a responsive site. It'll just like a mobile site on their mobile and a desktop site on their desktop, if you've got it right.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the problem as well, that there are quite a few people out there doing it wrong. And they believe that it's just a fluid website and that's it. Quite a lot of these responsive sites you jump onto could be upwards of 1 meg, 2 meg, which is crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Equally, there are a lot of apps out there in the various app stores that are just a web page and a little wrapper that makes it into an app. So, you know, they're pretty easy to maintain, I guess. And obviously, they're backed by the same data as the website, but they're perhaps not taking the best advantage of the technology they're using.
Yep. So I think we've kind of covered that. We're almost kind of getting into the native versus kind of HTML5 or responsive or whatever kind of debate there. So, if we take the assumption that we've decided we're going to go with responsive design, so what's the best way to implement? So Is it media? Obviously, we're using media queries. So is that in the CSS or in the HTML? Pixels versus percents and M's and so on and so forth. So how do we go about implementing responsive design?
Well, you start with the mobile first. That's the, well, before you even get to mobile, you start with the content. So content first. You look at your content and work out what needs to happen to your content for it to appear on a website.
And the absence of any media query is your first media query as well.
So is that as in, as soon as you start on a mobile phone, you don't need a media query because it's just going to be there?
That's all your baseline CSS.
Okay. So we've implemented that, and everybody's happy. And then we take it a stage further. Now, there's a attitude in the industry that I want to make a flashy iPad version. I actually worked beside Craig, and myself and Craig were in a meeting late on last week whereby we were discussing responsive design with a supplier, and the supplier was telling us that they understood responsive design and that everything was great, and then they asked us, but for the iPad version we'd quite like to make it kind of flashy, so we want to add in, and then they listed this horrendous pile of stuff that they wanted to add into the iPad only version.
Spam.
Yeah. I guess it is an education thing, but it's just a case of adding fluff. Fluff's the wrong word. A case of adding kind of bling to the larger versions, is it? Or is it enhancing the bigger versions, the mobile upwards, is it?
Yeah, it's enhancing. If you start mobile first and get your baseline CSS correct, like Ord's saying, so you're before you hit any media queries, you've got your base fonts, your base layout that won't break in things like BlackBerry, and then your first media query, you can start to introduce floats and whatever else, build up your sizes for there. It's the same as going back to principles like progressive enhancement, and just keeping things simple.
I mean, in the case of your client there, Paul, the idea that there was going to be an iPad version is kind of a misunderstanding of responsive design.
If I know.
there is no iPad version. That you don't have breakpoints at 767 pixels and 1,023 pixels or whatever, just so you get the perfect iPad landscape and perfect iPad portrait views. Your content, it all comes back to the content. You've got to make sure that whatever your content you've got, you design your breakpoints, your different views around that content so that it will appear okay on any device.
Absolutely. Amen.
Yeah, going back to what you said before, Ord, was getting your content first before you start anything at all. And with your client, Paul, the fact that they're trying to include more content at a larger device is sort of missing the point of the website. Mm-hmm. You want to be able to offer all the content that you need to offer your users at every breakpoint, rather than just say, well, we've got more room now, let's include more stuff. Well, if the stuff wasn't important at the mobile, why is it more important at the desktop level?
Yeah, display none is not a content strategy. I think, is that Jeremy Keith? Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that's necessarily the truth in the real world. I think, again, I've been working on a responsive site for a large price comparison website. So they're kind of next version of a responsive site. And this is forms, so it's pages and pages of forms and hugely different interactions for different devices. And it's the approach that we're taking is, would you want to complete your car insurance on your mobile? Or that's the sort of thing you might want to do on your iPad, but would you want to do that sort of thing and enter all that information in your mobile phone? Well, it's again back to this idea of what the tasks are drives what we should be doing with a mobile version of the website, because an app for them isn't going to work because it's a one hit a year thing for them. So an app's never going to work. So a responsive website or a website that works on a mobile is going to work for them. So I think there needs to be a much more pragmatic approach to responsive design. I think it feels a little bit like the early days of web standards, where you either did web standards or you didn't. And if you didn't do web standards, you were some kind of sort of heathen that needed to be burnt at the cross.
Okay, fair enough. But what that sounds like to me is not responsive design. It's different versions for different tasks, different contexts. It's not responsive design as coined by Mr. Marcotte. It's offering different different content to different people based on where they are and what they want to do, which is a perfectly sound strategy, but it's not responsive design.
I would suggest as well that if you're building different, even if you're building separate sites for mobile and for tablet, desktop, you still build those separate sites responsively. because you don't know what mobile they're going to be using. You don't know what tablet, what desktop they're going to be using. So you still, and you could get your detection wrong. It's not like that never happens. Yeah. So if you build it responsively, you're putting yourself in the driving seat. You're giving yourself the best possible chance for everything.
Amen.
I think you're right. I think you said response. I think responsively, responsibly, I think sounds a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
Joe, but I'd be interested to hear these journeys. So we take to these two use cases. Do they achieve the same goal at the end, or are these completely different? I mean, can you, on the stripped down mobile version that you would create, can you go through and achieve a full quote or not on mobile?
Yeah, you can do it. So we've done the whole lot. So you can get a full car quote or a full home insurance quote. It's quite an impressive piece of work. But yes, you can do it. So the approach we've actually taken is, I think Luke W. calls it REST. So it's kind of responsive with server-side stuff on top. So the problem we had on mobile with forms, especially, is on desktop, you can get away with forms that are very long. So, you know, you can have a one page, which is just all the information about your car. But on mobile, we had to split that into three smaller pages. So there were certain things we had to do that were kind of on top of the responsive nature of the page. So, you know, it would do things like dynamically do the width sizing again, because, again, we didn't know what mobiles we were targeting. But we had to do some work to reduce the number of form fields on one page to make it feel a little bit lighter on mobile.
Joe, was there any? Did you look into doing the same thing for the desktop at all during your research?
Yeah, we did. So forms are kind of been my thing for a few years now. So I've done a lot of user testing and research on forms, and it's kind of the bigger and longer forms weirdly perform better than shorter, sharper forms on the whole. So because conversion rates are obviously quite massive for a lot of price comparison sites, because they make their money on a huge amount of small margin transactions, we've optimized it for a longer page with as many, you know, with a certain number of questions on each.
All right, because forms is a bit of an interesting one. I mean, interestingly, the conversation that I just referred to, that myself and Craig were in a call on the other week, last week, was discussing an application form, one that is, as it stands, something in the region of about 8 pages long.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was where they were approaching they were going down the road of Craig, you probably remember better than me, but they were going down the road of basically everything being done on the JavaScript being downloaded at the very beginning, and then everything kind of being done just on AJAX calls after that.
Yeah, okay. I shut down when they said iPad version. So.
Yeah. Now, forms are a funny one. I mean, certainly in that space, so like comparison websites and things like that, there's lots and lots of information that you need to bring up to the customer straight away, so that the instant ones that jump out at me is kind of the kind of the documents that go along with the quote process. So information and all the legals and everything like that come along with it. And also a contact telephone number. So in those kind of scenarios, it's very difficult to kind of decide how best to lay that out in a responsive way.
Definitely. Especially the big problem with forms is they're really, really boring. Mm. And so, you know, if somebody's presented with like 10 form fields, it's just, you know, it's intensely dull. People go, oh, you can just see them sighing in front of your screen. So one of the things we've had to do with the forms as well is not only make them feel less like forms, so make it a bit more like a conversation. So again, to do anything new and exciting and interesting with forms and then do responsive on top of that was a real challenge, you know. So yeah, I mean, I could talk about forms. I could probably do a whole show on forms, but the big thing I found with doing responsive design in forms is not many people have written about it yet, and I can't wait for the site to go live so I can write about it. But there were so many things we've had to learn in the process of designing forms in a responsive way that it just, you know, there isn't any sort of seemingly any knowledge out there at the moment for us to learn from.
You mentioned Luke W. Already, Joe. Again, another great guy, and I think it was himself that co-authored the web form design
That's
book.
Right.
Yeah, another one for the show notes. Luke W. Web form design, fantastic book.
His stuff's really good, but his stuff's, I mean, he's revising a lot of the stuff I know at the moment. But he's, you know, a lot of his stuff with web forms, and he writes a lot on responsive. But his web form stuff is about 3 or 4 years old now, so it's kind of quite hard. It doesn't quite fit in the world we're in now, where forms on mobile are very different beasts from forms on desktop, you know, thumb keyboards and all that kind of stuff. It's a different, there's different learnings for developing forms. But actually on his website, he's written bits on forms on mobile. So he's done quite a lot up there.
The next thing I suppose to kind of discuss is the best way to lay out so that everything kind of nicely nests underneath each other in a responsive design view. So there's a number of ways that you can do that. The first of which is possibly using grid systems. Now, do you guys have any preference over grid systems? Do you like them? Do you not like them? What's the fors and against those?
I think grid systems are a good starting point for people learning responsive design. And also, if you're doing, I think with responsive design, you're doing a lot more prototyping with the client so that they can see how things are performing at each of the different breakpoints and on each device, I suppose. So things like Bootstrap and one that I use quite a bit is Foundation by Zurb. It's a really quick way to get something up and running for the clients to see and start giving you feedback and make it kind of an iterative process. But I think when it comes to building the site for the client at the end, I'm not a fan of grid systems because they put a lot of additional guff in that is not really required, and it's not as semantic as it could be if you built it from the ground up.
They also constrain you to work with their grid system. If what you want to do doesn't fit within that grid system, then you've got probably more work than building your own from scratch.
Mm.
So these are boilerplates we're talking about, yeah, as in the sort of templates. In terms of the grid theory of layout, I think they're fantastic, and I think every website should use them. But what we're talking about is boilerplates that constrain you in terms of the markup and the pre-styled columns and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, they're very good, as you say, for getting up and running fast. They'll do that for you. And if it's a simple site, that may well be all you need. But when you start getting, as with all these bootstraps and platforms and things, when you want to do something it doesn't do out of the box, it's a lot more work to munge the framework into what you want to do.
Okay. So
it's interesting how the web, you know, I think a few years back, 5, 6, and there was a lot of fluid websites about. And then this whole 960 grid appeared around about 2007, 2008, and a lot of sites went fixed width. I find that's one of the easy ways to explain to clients about responsive when you're talking the difference between fluid websites and fixed width ones. So love fluid. Fluid grids are fantastic.
So so there's kind of two things we're talking about there. So there's the grid system, which is predominantly used, and we can put some links in the show notes to kind of show what we're talking about if you've never seen grid systems. But they're predominantly used more in the prototyping and the design phase as opposed to the actual build phase. Would that be accurate? Because you're pretty much just following a grid that somebody else has designed, yeah?
A grid kind of imposes a sort of order on the arrangement of the elements on your page. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's horizontal grids in terms of you have columns like this and columns like this. So a typical grid is maybe 12 columns because you can split it into two or three or four. But you can also then get a typographic baseline grid, which goes vertically down the page, and everything just starts lining up very nicely. So they just kind of give you something to aim for so that everything kind of sits where it ought to on the page. In general, I'm a big fan of them. I think it makes a site look very smart if implemented properly.
If you've got any interest in typography, then look up Vertical Rhythm, and it'll change your life in terms of the way you build your CSS. It's fantastic building to a baseline height.
It will change your life briefly, and then you'll discover how limiting CSS is when you want to do that with type. And then you'll be like, why can't I set leading? And how do I know what leading is in the first place?
So that's one side of it is the grid system, but then we've also kind of mentioned there, so we've got kind of boilerplates as well. So probably the one that this is kind of the Twitter Bootstrap, which is kind of a boilerplate. And that, what we're kind of saying there is that kind of constrains you and adds too much cruft in. Is that what we're saying, or is there use cases for that kind of thing?
Well, Twitter Bootstrap's more like a full framework. It's got your styles there for components, typography, buttons, the whole lot. You can get some that are a lot more stripped down, 320 and up. Andy Clark's one, I think it's a lot more of a skeleton.
But there's another one called Skeleton, so don't confuse them.
So these kind of things are just for you to kind of almost add your design over the top of it, your design layer over the top of it, and it kind of does the work for you. Is that where you're going for that kind of thing?
It gives you a lot of sensible defaults. It gives you things like button styles. It gives you things like drop down menu styles. It gives you maybe a couple of JavaScript plugins that you can use for like a carousel or whatever else. What I like about Twitter Bootstrap, I use it quite a lot, is the fact that it's quite modular. So if you don't want that chunk of functionality that happens to do drop-down buttons, you don't have to include it. I mean, this is much easier these days now that we can kind of pre-compile our CSS from things like Less than Sass. But you can actually strip it down to just the bits you need quite quickly if you want to.
The downside, I'm using Twitter Bootstrap on a project at the moment, and the downside of it is it looks like Twitter Bootstrap. Yeah, unless you do some fairly heavy customization. I'm now going around having been using Twitter Bootstrap, I'm now going to sites and seeing Twitter Bootstrap.
It's that jumps black out bar across the top, isn't it? It's the black bar across the top that everybody seems to love and have. Yeah.
And I never leave that. I don't know why people do.
And there's button styles and there's UI widgets, and you just think that site's built with Bootstrap.
So
it's a very geeky thing, but once you're in it, you see it. You see everyone using it, and it becomes a bit homogenous.
It's the same as everybody using the 2010 WordPress theme, because they can't be bothered to put another one on. how do we get this into practice? Do we quote for it, or is it done stealthily? Or is it just, well, I suppose it's the same as stealthily, do we just do it? If we think the project requires it, do we just do it, or is it a case of quoting for it and selling it up to senior managers and whatnot?
I think you have to sell it.
Well, I can't really.
I think you have to make people aware.
I can't really speak for quoting for it because I've only worked with internal projects, and with internal, if you're not selling it, so selling your time to someone, then you should just be doing it.
Yeah, I think it's really difficult, and depends on whether it's an existing client or a new client. So if you go to a new client and you're pitching, and you're just going to put responsive design in there as a default and not sell it to them, your design quote is going to be 50% more than anyone else's. That's just going to do a fixed 960.
There's nothing stopping you building your fixed 960 to a fluid grid so that it's all there. You just need to move a couple
The cost of doing that, though, are going to be quite high. So it's, you know, it depends depends how you work. If you're so iteratively designing and building as you go through, then it kind of, you can do that stuff as you go along and there isn't an added cost. But I suppose a lot of organizations who kind of require a lot of stakeholders to be brought along for the ride, it becomes quite hard to sell responsive design, not only to them, but then to also bring them along with it. You're doing it, you know, even if you're just doing it for the sake of doing it as well.
You don't have to go the whole hog and make it flow around and this and the other, but you're building your fixed width site to a grid. So you make that grid a fluid grid.
That's
and
true.
You don't necessarily have all the breakpoints in the world ever. You have a couple so that it doesn't destroy itself on a small screen. You just put something in that's defensive.
But with those, you would need to design, or at least come up with how that's going to flow. And that does take extra work. So you do need to add that into your quote to your clients as well. Even if you're going to have two different breakpoints, a linear and a 960, you can be sure that whatever you decide will be the flow, the client's going to ask for things to go in different areas.
Anytime I go on a website now and it's not responsive or fluid, I just get disappointed. the same as Ords. If you're building with a Less or Sass or something like this, you can build, you know, a normal, what you looks like a normal static website, and it takes a couple of mix-ins just to make that fluid.
I know what you mean. I get really frustrated now because I can't like resize the browser window on my phone to find out how things change.
And the hardest thing is getting the clients to come to our way of thinking as well, because like responsive design is relatively new. Well, it's not, but it is for a lot of people. But it's, they're used to seeing a Photoshop file and then something replicated in the exact same way. And then so when we explain responsive design to them, they want to see, okay, so what's it going to look like on this device and this device and this device? And you end up having to come up with more Photoshop files. And then they don't kind of understand that, look, it's – It's an iterative process. We will move things. Things won't look right. We'll need to put a breakpoint in at 560 pixels, and this is what we're going to do with it. And it scares clients, but it also scares agencies because they know that the time with the client can just keep on going and going and going, and they're worried about, obviously, like, time is money, so they can't spend an inordinate amount of time with the clients getting these things right. So it's, I think we need like a change in mindset and how we approach it with the client and the designers from an agency point of view.
It's had a massive impact on things like testing and UAT, and in the business world, things like requirements. Like you say, previously you could quote on a visual design pixel perfect. Now, you know, we all know that things don't look the same in all browsers, but how do you define that with a supplier who's working against an estimate based on your business requirements? You have to define things like, if you're saying it can, you're having to define how, what broken means, for example. So everything must still be functional, but not look broken in terms of browser support for like legacy IE6 or IE7 or whatever. So it's having a big impact on things like UAT. Because the web's changing and because it's fluid as well, these testers are having to take a sample of, you know, 20 or so devices. But that's 20 times more testing than they would have to do on, say, I don't know, 4 or 5 browsers.
So that's actually a really good point there. So how do we deal with, or does it not matter to a degree, about browsers and browsers on mobile devices that don't support media queries?
That's where you start with your mobile first. You do a straight linear presentation, no floats, no nothing. It's all just one after another going down the page in a straight line with a set to 100% width. So it sizes with the browser. It doesn't look very nice, but then again, for browsers that don't have media query support, they're probably used to pages not looking very nice, and it'll actually look better. So you start with that for the really old devices. This is the absence of a media query. It's all one straight long line. Then you put in your first media query, which can be just essentially a null media query. Do you support media queries? If you do, right, we'll float this here, we'll move that there, we'll change the width of this to put it into two columns. And then you start it, then you put in your next media queries as you build out.
The biggest problem is actually not that browsers don't support media queries, but that their support in general is a bit kind of cobbled together. And I always recommend testing on as many devices as possible, because you find some phones that support media queries but don't support kind of some fairly basic kind of CSS3 stuff. So you get some very weird results. There's a guy I know here in Edinburgh who's actually just trying to set up a kind of community device testing lab. So I'm looking forward to going and having a play there, seeing how many devices he can pull together.
Just on the devices as well, you were speaking about testing on 5 different browsers on the desktop. Same with the iPad and the iPhone. I'll use them because I have them. You've got Chrome for them now. You need to test it on Chrome, on Safari, on Opera Mini as well. I'm surprised how badly some responsive sites look on Opera Mini, just because it's been ignored.
That's one of PPK's mantras. All web designers should be forced to test on Opera Mini first, because if you get it right in Opera Mini, you've got a 99% chance it's going to work everywhere else. If you get it right first for the latest bleeding edge version of Chrome and then try and hack it back, you're not doing progressive enhancement, you're back to graceful degradation. We do progressive enhancement for a reason. You get it right at the basics and build out. And if you get your valid semantic markup and you get your progressive enhancement, the rest of your life is a lot easier.
PPK, for anyone who doesn't know, is Peter Paul Koch, who writes very opinionated, quite often very angry screeds about standards on mobile and desktop browsers as well. But he's very well worth keeping up with.
Cool. Yep. Another thing we kind of mentioned earlier on that we didn't really go into much detail about was REST, so responsive and server side. I have to admit the main reason that I've come across this in the past is for images. For different images downloading and things like that. So, I mean, what's the ins and outs of that? I mean, by the very nature of it being server-side, it's not quite as simple as adding an extra media query into a page.
Well, the idea is that the server gets to know a bit about the device or the client or the browser, whatever it is, that is accessing the content, and then supply something that is appropriate to that device or browser or whatever it happens to be. So if it knows it's a mobile and if it can detect the mobile is not downloading very fast because it's a slow connection, it can send a very small compressed image. But if it's a mobile and it's on, this is maybe an extreme example, but a mobile on a wireless network doesn't care so much about what size of image it's downloading, so you can send it a better quality one. It's the kind of thing that mobile networks try to do for you that do it really, really badly. They compress all the data as you download. And it breaks things occasionally, which is the most frustrating thing in the world.
Yes, well, the problem with server-side solutions is pretty much the only information you're getting from the client is the user agent, which is an absolute mess because of the history of user agent detection. So we're trying to solve a mess by continuing that mess, which is why there are some solutions coming in now that mix the client and server side detection. So the classic, it used to be the classic mantra was use WRFL, the wireless universal resource file or something. And that gave you all sorts of information about a mobile phone. The problem is most of that information is no longer any use to you at all. And WRFL, they've now gone pay to play. There are some clones of that available.
The only other thing with REST that I find is that if you're working with a CMS, it can be difficult to use because you run into trouble with the caching of the pages as well. I think the University of Notre Dame, which I think is nd.edu, they did an implementation using REST to serve up like a very heavy image banner for desktop users, but for mobiles they don't get anything at all to save on the download. But they launched a fairly static site, so they're running with HTML, so the caching wasn't as much of an issue. If you are using a CMS and do want to implement something similar to REST, you can look at doing some lazy loading, so Ajaxing in pages after a particular time if you detect that it's a particular width. You're taking in assumptions that people are on desktops and things, but that's another way of achieving something similar to REST but without affecting your caching.
Okay. And I think also with REST as well, it's where do you stop as well? So the temptation is, you'll focus on a couple of, like an iPhone, for example, or an Android phone, but it ends up being at a point where, you would suddenly, you think, well, somebody says, well, we should do something specific for BlackBerry, and you start ending up, it can be kind of a bottomless pit, really, as to where you start with REST.
Yeah.
I've seen that as well.
Yeah, with REST, you need to try and get out of the mindset, because, again, working server-side with the user agent, you're thinking about what is this exact browser. You need to get out of that mindset and start thinking about device classes. So is this a mobile? Is this a tablet? Is this a desktop? And with the newer versions of the server-side detection, they work between the client and the server. So first load's always a bit tricky, but once you've got the first load out the way, you can then start talking between the client and the server to negotiate what the client can do so what the server can supply it.
Mm-hmm. It's all about capabilities and constraints. A lot of the good work that Brian and Stephanie Rieger are doing over at EBU in Edinburgh, I think that's where they talk about the capabilities and constraints.
Indeed. And there's also some ongoing discussion at the moment, jumping possibly into another topic here, about adaptive images and how you display a given image at a variety of different sizes on a device without necessarily needing to go into the server-side solution or the JavaScript client-side solution. There's a question there about which part of that browsing experience is responsible for deciding what kind of image should be displayed to the user. Is it the browser? Is it the server? Is it the web designer who's originally decided, the web designer's just decided on the breakpoint, so he knows what kind of image the user should be seeing. Well, no, the browser knows more about the user's context than the web design does. Well, what about the server? So there's a lot of discussion there about how these things interlink and what the best solution is. So obviously the technology is still evolving and we haven't got to the best answers yet.
I think you kind of struck on something that it's something we've not spoke about. So it's unsolved problems and the challenges that are kind of coming around the corner for this. So the adaptive images, and then of course you've got all the in fact, there was a whole course in WWDC for Apple just back in June there, where they were talking about the best way to implement Retina display images. And again,
but the answer to that is don't do what Apple did for their site, which was just chuck down huge Retina images to anyone on a Retina device.
Oh, lovely.
Well, yeah. But we are going to get in a world where it's kind of doing that a lot more. I mean, there's talk, whether you buy into it or not, there's talk of televisions and us having to deal with television. So it's kind of going response to the other direction. So at the moment, we're talking very much about kind of dealing with mobile phones and tablets. But we are going to very soon possibly have to be looking at kind of going right up the spectrum and how best to deal with that as well. And in that scenario, there's going to be the temptation to throw down massive, beautiful, big images that are going to work on a 50-inch telly. And then I suppose that's where REST comes in, I guess, is it?
Yes, the display density, so something like Retina display or a TV display, it's another signal into the melting pot here. So a Retina, if you've got an iPhone with a Retina display, the image it needs is still going to be smaller than an iPad with a Retina display, just because the screen is, the real estate is smaller. Yeah. So you've got to look at, it's not just Retina is a class, Retina is an element of the device. So the
you've
Retina's,
also got the different pixel densities across your different devices as well. So some coming at 2, some coming at 1.5, and that will continue to change as more devices are released.
That's
as well.
Device pixel ratio rather than pixel density, because pixel density comes in kind of logical pixels and physical pixels, dots per inch. And so for Retina displays, it's anything up to kind of 330 physical pixels per inch, but that still appears to the rendering engine as 160 something pixels per inch. So it all gets very confusing. Beyond images as well, obviously you want the images to be higher resolution to take advantage of the higher res display. You also start getting into the niceties of things like typeface rendering, because you have the ability to render them with more information. You can take it further. You can start relying on some of the granularity of the higher resolution to do some more interesting things with layout. I think it was Oliver Reichenstein of Information Architects redesigned his site just as the Retina stuff was all kind of appearing for the iPad 3. And he basically ended up kind of redesigning his typeface to take fullest advantage of it. And talking a lot about subpixels and things like this. So if you want to get really geeky about it, go and read his stuff.
Cool. On that subject, actually, how would I find out more about this? Now, there's possibly one obvious book that I'm going to jump in and just mention to begin with, which is, I've got the link for it here, yeah, so it's on A Book Apart, and it's Responsive Web Design by Ethan Marcotte. So we'll put a link in the show notes for that. So that's possibly the first place you would start, but where else would we get into this? Any other books you would recommend? Blogs, community groups, all that kind of thing?
Get on Twitter and check out Ethan Marcotte at RWD, Brad Frost, Jeremy Keith, Luke W, Scott Gell, you know, those types of filament group. You follow these guys and you'll have articles coming at you every week.
Yeah, I'd like to say Luke Rabluska, Luke W, he's fantastic. I don't know where he finds the time to write all the stuff he does, but his blog is just full of information. And he's also really good at going to conferences and then writing up like every talk he sees. It's insane.
Yeah, he's a one-man writing machine, Luke, isn't he? Yeah. His stuff's great. What I like about his stuff as well is he does put a lot of UX thought and user thought into what he does as well. So he's kind of very different from the guys that are at the bleeding edge of doing it. He sort of takes much more of a pragmatic approach to doing it or at scale or just kind of doing it properly as well. So I really like Luke's stuff, definitely. He's great.
Luke W, we salute you.
Justin, do you want to do a plug for your email newsletter here?
Yeah, each week we send out a responsive design newsletter, so you can get that, sign up and subscribe to that at responsivedesignweekly.com. So each week I try and focus on something new. Something we didn't talk about, which I'd covered previously, is advertising on with responsive design as well. So each week we'll focus on something new and see what's been happening around the traps.
Cool. Grant, so this section of the web show is brought to you by Pusher. So if you're developing or thinking of developing a web or mobile app that has live updating content, activity streams, chat, real-time blogging, second screen apps, multiplayer games, and much, much more, then you need Pusher. Pusher is an HTML5 WebSocket-powered service that makes adding these sort of features easy. Pusher removes the headache of configuring and scaling real-time infrastructure so that you can concentrate on developing features. So if you could head on over to pusher.com/webshow, so that's pusher.com/webshow, and sign up for the free sandbox plan. Then once you've had a bit of a play in that and you're ready to upgrade, if you enter webshow_bootstrap, all one word and in capital letters, you can claim your free 3-month bootstrap plan. So that's webshow_bootstrap, and that gives you a free 3-month bootstrap plan with Pusher for you to play away to your heart's content. So thank you very much for Pusher for sponsoring the web show. If you could head over there and show your support, that would be much appreciated. So on to the next section, which we're mainly going to be looking at listener questions and follow-up. So this is a section of the show that we basically ask you, the listener, for to send in your questions relating to the topic at hand or any other web design questions or web development questions that you want. We actually did have a few extra this week that I'm not going to go into, primarily because I as I suspected, we had a lot to say about responsive design. So I'm just going to cover the three responsive design related questions just now. So the first one is from A. Patterson. So thank you for getting in touch. Am I better using max-width or min-width for responsive design breakpoints?
It depends. What are you trying to do? If you're starting small and going up, then you usually use, now, is it min or max width? I can't remember which one it is.
Min width would be mobile first and max width.
Yes.
The other way. Usually yep. You end up with max width, I find, if you're trying to responsify an old site, so something that's already been built, you end up putting in those max widths to break it down, which is kind of the wrong way. But
I've been adding in some cheeky min-max rules as well, because what I was finding was when I was going mobile first and adding lots of mins, just building up, letting the CSS stack, when you bounce out to, you know, whatever your breakpoint is for desktop size, I was having to override the styles I was setting from earlier as well. So like Ord said, it just depends.
Mm. Hey, just a quick question before we go on to another one. Are you guys using pixels or m's or percents for your breakpoints? Or not percents for your breakpoints, but pixels or m's for your breakpoints?
It depends.
I'm still using pixels, to be honest, at the moment, but I feel dirty saying it.
For typographic things like your paragraphs and things like that, then, and some of the broad brush stuff, then M's are often better. But if you're dealing with stuff that's got images in it and has got fixed width media, logos, for example, and some things, then sometimes you have to use the pixels because that's what you're dealing with. So M's broadly for defining content areas, pixels, sometimes you've got to use them because of your content. So it's content driven again.
I'm trying to ignore the whole thing by using less than SAS to compile my style sheets, and therefore I just kind of put calculations in them. And if they end up as pixels, that's fine by me. If they end up as M's, that's fine by me. Provided it adheres to the calculation that I've put in, that's what I want.
Okay. Okay, moving on to the next question. This is from Stuart Brown. Thanks for emailing in, Stuart. I have responsively built my WordPress website. I've created the images like this, and it's .post space image, then bracket max-width 50%. This works for the width, but the height stays the same and looks out of proportion. What do I need to add to get the height to stay in proportion?
I was looking at something very similar just the other day on one of my sites, and it's what you need to take out. What I expect is happening is something is being clever and putting a height or height onto the image in the image tag. This is what caught me. Despite looking at it for far too long, Firebug, I didn't spot that. So I've seen WordPress does that on some images. It looks at the image and tries to put a height and width in. So if something's explicitly setting a height, it'll override the proportional resize you get with the CSS. So that's something I've seen in my experience. I don't know if that's what's happening here, but I'm trying to put two and two together.
Okay.
I mean, I would say the other thing you can't do is you can't set both a max width and a max height. It's one or the other.
Okay. So it can,
you could set perhaps set the height to auto in this case may affect it.
So there's there's not enough information there really. We kind of need to know more, but that's at least a couple of things we could try. Stuart, if that doesn't work, by all means, email us back in with a little bit more information. We can maybe try and answer it on a later show if either of those things don't work. But let us know if those work. It'd be interesting to find out. And finally, the last question for tonight is from Andrew Carter. What is better, breakpoints in the CSS file or in the head region?
It depends.
CSS.
Well, the advantage of putting your breakpoints in the head, in the definitions of the CSS includes, is most browsers, I'm not sure exactly without doing a lot of testing which ones, won't download a style sheet that it doesn't need. So if you've got a narrow device and you've got a CSS file put on for a wider breakpoint, it won't necessarily download it, saving you time. But the disadvantage is, on the wide device, it's extra HTTP requests, which are an order of magnitude worse than a bigger file. And if you've got something, when you change orientation on a device, if it crosses two breakpoints, you're going to get a big solid pause as it downloads that new CSS. So generally, sticking in the CSS file, unless you've got a specific reason to put them in, and you've benchmarked it and done your work.
You could do a hybrid approach where you have a basic breakpoint in the head and then everything else in the related CSS.
Okay. Justin, you jumped right in there and said CSS. Was that because you were kind of going to say a similar thing there to Ord, or do you have a different opinion?
Yeah, that exactly the same as what Ord said. It kind of does depend, but yeah, I'm a big fan of the one file being brought down. I know some people like to split their CSS up into based grid typography and things like that. So maybe people also like to define all their breakpoints within one CSS file, but I would go, define them in multiple CSS files, but I would go with just the one, download it once. It's not too big.
Yep.
Grant, so finally, we just have a little bit of feedback from last week. Simon Wheatley was on the show, and we were talking about WordPress, and he mentioned a Types plugin that was free that had an extra views plugin that had a charge. And after the show, he actually spoke to the developer, and he got a discount code. I had it in the show notes last week, but I'm just mentioning it now. So it's normally $49 for this function. It's called WP UK Views. It's called WP Types. The voucher code is WP UK Views, all capital letters. It's available till August the 15th. So if you head on over to wp-types.com and you want that plugin, you can go there. We'll stick it in the show notes again this week, or you can see it in the show notes from the last show, the WordPress show. Next thing thank UK2. This podcast and all the others wouldn't be possible without UK2. They've kept the British Tech Network afloat for over 3 years now, and they're pretty fantastic, and you should use them. We have a whole pile of voucher codes for various discounts and services from UK2. The best thing to do is if you head on over to britishtechnetwork.com, click on the sponsors link on the top, and then you will see all the voucher codes there. So that'll give you all sorts of discounts off of DNS, domains, VPN, servers, VPS, and so on and so forth. Click on the UK2 link on there and fill your basket with all you need, and then use all the voucher codes in there to get some money off. We'd also really appreciate when you're logging in and out of your account if you could come through the britishtechnetwork.com and click on the link, because we get the kudos for sending you there. It'd be preferable if you also use them when you're putting in the voucher codes as well, so UK2 know that you came from us and didn't find them on a voucher code site. So that's it, UK2, they support British Tech, and you should support them. And finally, gentlemen, do we have any cool things? Ord, I'll start with you. What have you got for us?
Yep, in theme with today's show, I've gone with Detector from Dan Molson. It's what I was talking about earlier with the REST. It's a combined client-server browser capability detection. So it relies on Modernizer in the browser, and it essentially ties user agents to capabilities, and it builds this list up itself. It doesn't rely on a downloaded database. So it's built, if you use it on your site, it'll be built to represent your users.
Okay, very cool. Is there a cost to that?
No, that's GitHub. Completely open source. It's on GitHub.
GitHub, yeah. Cool. Grand. We like free. Joe, what have you got for us tonight?
I've got a nice one, actually. It's from some guys called Metal Toad Media, and it's a simple device diagram from responsive design planning. So it's kind of a nice way of planning what your... In fact, something we didn't talk about too much, which was planning what your breakpoints are. So it's a great way of saying, well, if these are your breakpoints, these are some of the devices you can expect to get within these sets of sizes. So it lets you know if you should be doing 3, 4, 5, 6 breakpoints. And it's quite nice as well for explaining to your clients and customers as well about what and how you'll be designing stuff too. And there, yeah, just if you just search for Metal Toad simple device diagram responsive design, you should find it. But it's a really, really nice resource.
Cool. Ian, what do you have for us?
This week, Paul, I've got just a nice couple of little projects that were put together by a guy here at Edinburgh called James Mullers. He works for Adobe, but he builds some nice little things on the web. So the first thing he's built is something called Responsive Layouts Responsively Wireframed. So you can go to this page and you can resize it, and there are some little wireframes on the page, and they change either as you resize the page or as you kind of flick between the mobile and desktop views. So you can kind of see how the various content blocks might collapse and how the layouts simplify. And you can get an idea of how you might build some more complex layouts from it. But it's also a really neat thing for kind of demonstrating to clients, how that sort of stuff works in a wireframe view. There's a second one in his projects, which is just a very simple view. It's you go to the page and there's a desktop there. And as you resize the browser window, the desktop morphs into a laptop and then morphs down into a tablet and then turns into a portrait tablet and then turns into a phone and so on and so forth. So you can actually show people who aren't familiar with responsive design how the page can change to fit the different devices by changing the page and demonstrating the devices. So these projects are at his website, which is www.thismanslife.co.uk/projects/lab, and there's a few other nifty cool things in there as well. Very smart guy.
Cool, very cool. And Craig, what do you have for us?
I have one that's not related to responsive, but it's still awesome. If this, then that. It's called Mr. Saunders introduced me to this tool, and it's changed my life. Every now and again, one of these tools comes along that's just unbelievable and changes the way you work. Like, Firebug in Firefox or something like that. It is this good. It's billed as social plumbing. So it basically ties together your APIs for all your kind of social sites and any other kind of RSS and email and a whole load of other services. Basically, you throw together these recipes and you say, if this happens, do this. So, for example, I've got it set up to, if something goes in an RSS feed, trigger this or post it to Twitter. It sounds quite simple. Once you get using it, you realise the possibilities are endless. So, if this, then that. It's at ifttt.com.
Great. That is a fantastic tool. I use that quite often as well. It's it's amazing that they're not charging anything for that as well. Pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really, really handy. It's a really nice tool.
Mm. Yeah. And finally, Justin, are you still awake, sir?
Yeah, still awake.
What do you have?
Nearly
for
6 a.m.
Yeah.
I've got two. The first one is from a guy over in the UK. It's jordanm.co.uk/content choreography. And he's done a demo which uses the display box to reorder content using CSS rather than the semantics of the HTML itself. It's really cool. It's not supported across every browser at the moment, but it's in there as a recommendation. It's very good demo to have a look at. And the other one is one that I use on a daily basis called Media Query Bookmarklet by Sparkbox. What it is just a bookmarklet in your browser, and when you click on it, it tells you which media queries are currently being used within your CSS. So it's really nice to see at what point your site's jumping and which media queries are being fired. So it's very helpful for development.
Very cool. And are those free resources as well, are they?
Yes.
Yes, that's grand. Ah, another clean slate of completely free picks this week. Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And finally, my one is, and this is actually something that I picked up from Justin's Responsive Design Weekly, was the grid setup from Mark Bolton Design. Now, I have to admit, I've just signed up, requested a beta invite, and I've not been accepted yet. However, I have watched the video, and it looks like a really cool way of kind of pulling together grids, as we mentioned, as we discussed earlier, responsive grid. So if you head on over to gridsetapp.com and watch a video there, and you can see what I'm talking about. So yeah, and you can request a beta invite there as well for get access to it. So that's basically us. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for joining us tonight. We had quite a good discussion. I'm sorry, but we had a little bit of audio problems at the beginning. We had I'll hopefully try and edit those out, but we had a bit of a delay in some of the conversations at the beginning. But not to worry. So finally, we just go around everybody, and where can we get a hold of you? So we'll begin with Craig. Where's the best place to get a hold of you?
You can get me on Twitter at Craig McFeet or craigmcfeet.co.uk.
Grand. Have you updated that website yet? The last time you were on, you said that URL, and then we realised that it just said, I'm not taking any work at the moment, in Times in the top left-hand corner.
No, it was updated then, and it's still the same. It's got a blog on it now. It's got a blog.
All right, that's good. That's good. Ord, where can we get hold of you?
I'm at Decade City, all one word, on the Twitters, and I'm decadecity.net on the blogs.
Grand. Joe, where can we find you?
So I'm Mr. Joe, MRJOE, on Twitter, and I've been blogging a lot at the company I work for, which is CX Partners in Bristol. So finding me, I type in CX Partners, there's lots of great stuff we've been posting up on responsive design, as well as loads of other stuff at the moment.
Very cool. And Ian, where can we get hold of you?
On the Twitters as Maniac Yak, that's MANIACYAK. And I look forward to the day when I have time to put up a website again.
And Justin, where can we get hold of you?
On Twitter, it's at Justin Avery. And you can grab me at justinavery.me as well.
Great. And finally, I'm at Paul Wheatley on Twitter. That's Paul, W-H-E-A-T-L-E-Y. You can follow the network on Twitter. That's British Tech News on Twitter. If you want to send us any questions around anything we've discussed tonight, or you have any problems that you want to add in and we'll try and answer them in the next show, you can email those over to britishtechnews@gmail.com. It would really be great as well if you could head on over to iTunes and give us some ratings and some love in iTunes there. Reviews and ratings really help us get up the rankings, and we'd be doing quite well on the homepage of the technology podcast on Twitter recently, so it'd be great if those could continue. We'll be back in 2 weeks with our next show, which will be the ins and outs of user experience, so I will look forward to seeing you then. So thank you very much, gentlemen, and yes, we'll see you in a couple of weeks. Thanks very much.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Best podcast ever.